This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication.
Hi, this is Johnny Bluestar. Today's guest has one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard. His name is Robert Snow, and he is a retired police captain and homicide detective that was working in the Indianapolis Police Department with a superb record of dealing with the most challenging of police assignments. The story you're about to hear in this interview is unusual because, although there are by now many stories about reincarnation out there, seldom has the subject of these stories been as fully qualified to seek for proof as Bob Snow, a detective. The evidence that Bob Snow was after was to validate the reality of a past life incarnation. That's right. Under the capable hands of a hypnotist who specialized in hypnotic regression, Bob Snow had an experience that was to throw him off the train, a train that was on a rather standard track of believing that reincarnation was a New Age fantasy, incapable of being proved or understood objectively. His book is called Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic and is one of the most engaging books I've ever read. Why so engaging? Simply because it is so riveting and so very unusual, like a good detective story. Actually, maybe more accurately, a mystery story, which it really is. So let's get going. How's it going today, Bob?
Fine. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it's a real pleasure, and it's very exciting for me. Before we get into the guts of your story, tell us a little bit about your own background. I understand that since you were young, you always wanted to be a writer.
Actually, that's the only thing I ever wanted to be. Since my youngest age of 04 or 5, when everyone would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, the only thing I ever said was a writer. I never wanted to be anything else. I'm not sure why, but I always wanted, that's all I ever wanted to be, was a writer.
Well, that's cool. I know, because I kind of experienced wanting to be a writer when I was really young, like in second grade myself. You know, I think the circumstances of your growing up were very interesting, but not all that easy. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Indianapolis, and kind of a rough side of Indianapolis called Brightwood, and I had grew up with 7 brothers and 3 sisters, so it was needless to say it was a tough childhood. You have to say, we lived in a three bedroom house with slept in one room with 7 brothers. So it was needless to say it was different. It was interesting growing up. It was crowded, but there's always something going on. Needless to say,
sounds a little bit like going to summer camp.
Yeah, except permanently, yes.
Yes. Well, one of the interesting things about your life is that you actually did become a writer, a rather prolific one, but you also had a very productive career as a police officer, 38 years, retiring in the rank of captain after running the homicide division as its commander for quite a number of years. And before that, you were actually an intelligence officer during the war in Vietnam. Tell us a little bit more about these aspects of your career.
Well, when I turned 18, of course, this was 1965, and the Vietnam War was starting to get hot, and I got drafted a couple weeks after I turned 18. So I went down, I was a smart job when you're 18. I'm not going to get drafted and serve 2 years. I went down and signed up to the Air Force for 4 years. But anyway, I got into intelligence, and it was a fascinating job. It really was. I did intelligence during the Vietnam War, and it was a great job. Then when I got out, I never ever gave up on being a writer. But when people start out being a writer, no one starts out being a writer as your number one, as your number one career. You always have to have another career to support you until you get established. And so when I got out in the USA, I was looking for a job. And my brother had become an Indianapolis police officer about 7 or 8 months before that. And of course, this is still during, this was 1969, and the Vietnam War was still going on, and they were really, the police department was desperate for new officers, since all the fit, you know, the physically fit people were being drafted and sent off to Vietnam. So I went down and applied just to have a job, to, you know, to tide me over while I was going to become a writer. And it was actually a very good decision, because not only was it a good job, but I stayed there 38 years, but it gave me tons of subject material for my writing. Everything I've written practically is about police work, because that's
until
what
you
know.
Took a little diversion, right?
In a way, no. Because my book on reincarnation is a book about investigation. It was a very intense, long-term investigation. So in a way, it borders on police work too, because again, it was not just a case of a fantasy or what I'd like to have happen. This is something I did a really deep investigation into.
Well, you were very successful, particularly in running the homicide division, and obviously before you became its commander, you were a detective yourself. So you had a lot of experience in investigations of the most serious kind.
Well, yeah, homicide is it's the most serious kind. I was a commander there for 6 years. Believe me, that's a long time to be commander of homicide, because as commander of homicide, you kind of ride the wave of homicides. As long as they're staying even or going down, you're fine. When they start going up, they get rid of you. It's kind of like a football team. When a football team's doing bad, they don't fire all the players; they fire the coach. Well, that's the way it was. Homicide. I was there 6 years, and I had a very good record there. Our homicides went down the whole time I was there, and we had an 83% clearance rate, which is remarkable for a city of our size.
I think it's interesting that you're a homicide detective, and now you're sort of an after-death detective to some degree. Well, in this discussion, we're about to, and I'm alerting our audience, we're about to plunge into a world of phenomena that most people in Western countries disbelieve in, and probably have never investigated, despite the subject's occasional surfacing in books and media. What was your attitude before your journey into the realm of what might be called the supernatural or paranormal, the reincarnation experience?
Well, again, I was a police officer for 38 years. As a police officer, all you deal with is physical evidence, things you can see, things you can touch, things you can show to other people as solid evidence. So I never give much thought to the otherworldly things like reincarnation, you know, life after death, this type of thing. That sort of thing really did concern me, and I didn't give it any, especially the idea of reincarnation. I didn't give it any credence at all. I thought it was simply a Far Eastern belief and maybe a New Age belief by a small number of people in the United States. But I didn't believe the majority of people believed in it, and I didn't believe in it.
After your experience, did you look into more of the various books and YouTube discussions of reincarnation?
Even after I started looking into it, even after I got involved, it took me a long time before I actually believed there was such a thing. I held out to the very last minute because, again, I've always had a very orderly, structured life built on solid things that could be seen and felt. So even as I was doing my investigation, no matter what I found, I was still resisting. I was certainly resisting believing in it.
Well, I just want to point out, I don't know if you've heard of it, but there's a very interesting story about a lady who surfaced in Europe who believes she's a reincarnation of Anne Frank. Have you heard of that one?
Yes, matter of fact, I've met her.
Really?
Yeah, my only problem, I'm not, you know, listen to me, I'm not passing judgment on her or not on her, on her or case or any other case. I just have a hard time to believe it. People believe they always, when people find out they are a reincarnation, it's always someone famous. And I always find that interesting because, you know, for every famous person, there's at least a 10, 20 million people who and hardly left any record of themselves at all. And what's the odds that everybody who is going to be, who goes through a regression, who believes they found their past life, is someone famous in the past? Oh, I always find it hard. And another thing I always have, my belief is that you cannot prove that you had a past life unless the person you were in the past life was so obscure that there's no way you could actually stumble on information about him. Because if I said I was Van Gogh or Renoir or some famous painter, everyone would say, yeah, but you read about him, you see movies about him, and that's where all this information came from. My total belief is the person has to be so obscure, there's no way you could have stumbled onto this evidence.
Well, let's go on to another point here. After your first wife died, and tragically, you eventually married Melanie, who was somewhat of a partner in the events which have shaped your life recently. Tell us a little about her.
Yeah, Melanie was also a detective. Matter of fact, she's probably one of the best detectives I've ever met. She was a child abuse detective for a lot of years and a narcotics detective for a lot of years. And actually, her help to me in this case wasn't really voluntary. She was more on wanting to prove me wrong, and which is always helpful. It's always helpful to have a devil's advocate in any kind of investigation like this, so you can see that person like that can see your weak points and see things you have missed. But I was glad to have her help me because, like I said, she is an excellent, one of the best detectives I ever met, and I wanted someone besides me to look at the things I had found to see if I was overlooking something or if I hadn't seen something I should have seen.
Well, we're going to go to a break now, but before we do, I'm going to say that we're about to plunge into the actual how you got into the experience and what happened, which is just phenomenal. So we're going to take the break right now. We are happy to provide our audience with two very exciting musical odysseys with Stephanie Slevin, a singer-songwriter from the United Kingdom. One is called Show Number 7, The Galaxy of Song, and the other is Show 21, I Talk with Angels, in our Threshold Radio archives in VegasAllNetRadio.com and YouTube. Here's one of our songs.
Goodbye, my love. Goodbye, my love. I'll see you on the virgin shore. And when time doth fare me well, we will be as one once more. Goodbye, my love, I'll miss you so, for I don't want to let you go. But in dream you said to me that by my side you'll always be. And wherever I do roam, that you will be my telephone. Goodbye, my love, goodbye, my love. Goodbye, my love, goodbye, my love. Goodbye, my love, you fare thee well. And in due time my heart will tell. Everything you've shown to me, how to reclaim my dignity. Goodbye, my love, I fare thee well. You are the soul that rings my bell. And wherever I do roam, you are the heart within my home. Goodbye, my love, goodbye, my love. I'll see you on the virgin shore. And when time doth fare me well, we will be as one once more. Goodbye, my love, goodbye, my love. Goodbye, my love, goodbye, my love.
My company, New Galaxy Enterprises, is a California corporation specializing in the creation of media and promotional content. We are focused on original, innovative projects that are good for humanity. These projects could be nonfiction books or novels, fictional screenplays or documentary content, websites and website content, commercial advertising content for print, audio, or video products on the internet, television, or radio, musical scores for advertising, television, or film, video, audio editing, etc. We want to promote products and projects that support the environment, encourage a healthy experience in living,
developing, nurturing, and useful technology, and offering platforms for positive, socially constructive entertainment or informative, transformative media. Our experience in creating a variety of products like this is rather vast, and we offer client-based and collaborative products, as well as the opportunity of active investors to join us in the creation and promotion of proprietary products, some of which are in latter stages of development. For more information, go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. That's www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. If you're interested in talking to us, just fill out the contact sheet and we will get back with you.
Boots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who is a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of this stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was six. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy, we ditch the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in the stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle.
We're back with Robert Snow and a rather remarkable story of past lifetimes. Robert, I believe your first little excursion in the past lifetimes investigation, at least intellectually, was from a book you received in a book club called Coming Back, which was written by Dr. Raymond Moody. How did that book affect you?
Well, you know, when you're a writer, you just can't write all the time, too. Another thing you have to do, you have to read, and you have to read a lot. And you can't just read from your field. You have to read from all different fields to see how authors handle things. In other words, if something's really good, why was it good? And if it's bad, why was it bad? Because of this, I belong to a number of book clubs and I do a lot of reading. Well, one time I won a book club thing. I had a book called Coming Back by Dr. Raymond Moody. And basically, it was about Dr. Moody had done some investigation in near-death experiences. And apparently, he had a friend who was a past life regressionist. And she talked him into being hypnotized and mostly taken back to, I think it was like 8 or 9 past lives. Anyway, so I ordered the book. It sounded interesting, but I didn't give it any kind of, you know, credence or belief, but I thought it sounded interesting. And again, you want to see how other writers handle subjects. So I got the book and I read it. It was a very well-written book about how he goes to his friend. She hypnotizes him and takes him back to all these past lives he's supposed to have had. But it's kind of funny because at the end of the book, he kind of hedges a bit, says, "Nah, I'm not sure what this was." He's not really sure it's past lives. It might just been, you know, his imagination or subconscious suggestions, what have you. And that's kind of how I felt at the time. I thought, yeah, it's interesting. But anything you think is past life is probably more likely memories from this life brought up to your subconscious mind and just reordered to make them look like stories. So I didn't give it much more thought. I read the book and went on to other readings. So it was interesting, but I didn't really believe it more than he did.
Well, you know, I think you wound up doing a lot more investigation than he did about your past lifetimes.
Yeah, I did eventually, yes.
Sometime after you read that book, you happened to be chatting in a function at the Marion County Family Advocacy Center with a friend of your wife. Like your wife, Melanie, Kathy Graban was a child abuse detective, but she was also a practicing psychologist who used hypnotic regression therapy. When you expressed your skepticism about this book to Kathy, Kathy kind of challenged you. Can you explain what she said and how this challenge affected you?
Well, I said we were at a party, and I was talking to Kathy, and we were just making small talk, as people do at parties, you know, about movies we'd seen and everything, and started talking books you read. And I remember this book, and I just kind of mentioned it. Now, at this time, I didn't know that Kathy used past life regression or practice. I didn't know it was even used that much myself at that time. So she asked me what I thought of the book, and it had been late in the party, and I had a bit to drink. And I think I was probably a bit obnoxious, and I kind of made fun of the book. I kind of made fun of the whole idea of past life regression. That, you know, my point to her was, if there's such a thing as past lives, why hasn't anyone ever proven it? Why hadn't anyone ever shown proof of it? And again, I think I maybe got a little overbearing. But Kathy was very nice, very gracious, and she listened to me. And eventually, it got to the point where she basically dared me. Said, "If you think it's so silly, why don't you try it?" And at first, I said, "No, I ain't doing that. I'm not doing that." And then it got to the point. Got down to the point. Gee, are you scared? And you know, you don't want to ask a man or a police officer scared. Of course, you're not scared. And eventually, I said yes. I said I'd do it. And she wrote down the name of a colleague of hers who did past regression, and says, "Go see this and try it yourself and see what you think." And I said I would. But you know, the next morning you wake up and you know you're a lot more clear-headed, and I think, I ain't doing this. This is stupid. I'm not doing it. But then it seemed like, every time, you know, it's funny, before this, I didn't run to Kath that often. But it seemed like after this, I would run into her every day. And when I'd see her, she'd always ask me, say, "Have you made the appointment yet?" And I'd always make some flimsy excuse about how, you know, I've had meetings and reports, things, and we had so many homicides and this kind of thing, I couldn't do it. But it seemed like I'd run into her all the time, and it would drive me nuts. You know, you'd say, "Oh, God, there she is again," you know, and you'd make up some flimsy excuse. So finally, what happened, I got tired. After 5 or 6 times, I thought, this is silly. You know, you had to hide from somebody, you know. So I finally said, okay, I went ahead and made the appointment with this friend of hers. It was a Dr. Mary Ellen Griffith. And what Dr. Griffith told me when I called her, she said, "If you want to, you can bring your own tape recorder if you want to record a session." And I thought that was really a good idea, because what I was planning on doing is I wanted to go to this session. I had made my mind up. I was going to this session, and I was going to cooperate with Dr. Griffin 100%. But I was going to record it, and I'm going to show Kathy how silly it all was, because then I was convinced absolutely nothing would happen. It would just be an hour of my wasted time. But I wanted to prove to Kathy that I've been right, that this is all silliness. There was no truth to it.
When you went to see her the first time, what was your first impression of her? I mean, was it strange, or was it ordinary?
Dr. Griffith is a very nice lady, very gracious lady. It's kind of funny because her office looked just like I thought a psychologist, psychiatrist looked like. You know, she had an old desk and a chair and a leather couch, and that was it. It's just the way I thought about it. But she was a very nice lady, very gracious, had kind of a funny, kind of a musical voice, very soothing kind of musical voice. And she was very gracious, and you know, we talked for a little bit, and she was a very, very nice lady. And I kind of liked her immediately.
How did you? How did the regression session begin?
Well, she asked me. She says, "Well, gee, what kind of problems do you think you need help with?" And I told her, "Really, I said, I don't have any problems. I told her I just thought past life regression was interesting, and I wanted to try it." And she didn't have any problem with that. She said, "Okay, no problem." She said, "Well, sit down." Well, actually, she's gonna go to the couch. I didn't lay down. I thought, "No, that's too much. Like you need, you really need help," type thing. And I was still convinced that time I was going to show Kathy how silly this was. So I sat on the couch, and she said, "Close your eyes," and I did. And she started talking. Said, "Tell me about your college graduation." And so I told her about my college graduation, and then she went down and asked me about something about. She said, "Tell me something about high school, you know, grade school." And I could see what she's doing. I remember thinking at the time that she wouldn't be a very good interrogator, because you could anticipate what her next question was going to be. And believe me, as an interrogator, you never want your subject to know what your next question is going to be, because you can prepare for it. But anyway, she kept asking earlier memories. And I could see what she's doing. But again, I thought, hey, I'm cooperating 100%. I'm going to tell her everything she wants, you know, that I can think of. I'm not going to make anything up, certainly. I'm not going to tell her something I don't see, but I will cooperate just so I can show Kathy how silly it is.
Did you buy into her methodology when she asked you to rely on the guidance of the higher self in your regression?
Well, I thought it was kind of amusing, because she told me before we started that on our trip, there would be a spirit guide of mine called inner self that would protect me. And she said, "Might just circle me with a white light, protect me." And I thought, I almost had to keep laughing. I've been a police officer for a long time, and I'd say I'd been in a lot of dangerous, scary situations. I didn't think anything I would see sitting in a psychiatrist or psychologist office was going to scare me. But I went along with her. Okay, I nodded. I agreed. Whatever she wanted, I was going to go along with her. And I listened to her and nodded and everything, but I thought it was kind of silly at the time because, again, I didn't think I could see anything that I had that would certainly scare me.
Well, You know, in the very beginning, she asked you to imagine yourself in another room in your den at home, seated in a comfortable chair. Why do you think she placed you in another, in your own body, but in an imaginary body?
I don't know. The only thing I found about Dr. Griffin's method was, is she employed a lot of imagery. You know, imagine this, imagine you're here. She told me, find the most comfortable spot in your house, imagine yourself sitting there, imagine your inner self telling you that we're going on a trip, this kind of thing. I know she involved a lot of imagery in her work. I'm not sure why. Again, I wasn't skilled in hypnotism. I didn't really know that much about it then, so I just went along with whatever she said.
Well, what did you think about the balloon ride?
Well, she did all this imagery about going to, back in earlier memories. She said, all right, so I want you to imagine a balloon. Can you see a balloon? And actually, I was sitting there with my eyes closed. I've been sitting there probably about 15 minutes so far with my eyes closed. And I could see a big purple blob on my eyes. I assumed it was just light coming in from the window. There was a window to my right. But I could see a big purple blob on my eyes. I told her, yeah, I can see a purple balloon. And she told me, she said, all right. She says, get in the balloon. And she said, you and your inner self are going to take a trip. So I said, she said, try imagine that. So I'm still being cooperative. I want to cooperate so I can show how silly this all is. So I cooperate, and she says, oh, we take the balloon. She says, all right. She says, can you see lights down below you? And interesting enough, out of the bottom of my eyelids, I could see the little points of light down below, but I assumed it was simply reflection off the floor. So anyway, she goes, okay, says, now I want you to land the balloon. Now, again, I told you I'm going to cooperate, but I'm not going to see anything I don't see. I'm not going to make anything up. And so nothing happened. And she says, well, I'll land the balloon. And we went through this probably a dozen times about landing the balloon. And she said, there's a control over your head. Reach up and pull the control, land the balloon. Nothing happened. Absolutely nothing. And about the 10th or 12th time of doing it, I thought, this is what it is. People are just tired. Because by that time, I was kind of tired. I'm sitting there. She had an unbelievably hard couch. That was the hardest couch I ever. She'd also been on people to stay longer than an hour. My buttocks were hurting. My back was starting to hurt. And I can understand now why people would make up stories that want to get out of there. But again, I was not going to. So I just stepped aside. I didn't see anything. I told her, I'm sorry, nothing's happening.
Well, you know, in a few minutes after our break, which will be on shortly, we're going to discuss that maybe you were a little bit deeper into it than you thought. Now we'll take our break.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We can take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
My God, are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, the creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
New Galaxy Enterprises is a media company specializing in wide-ranging content like novels, nonfiction books, screenplays, commercial advertising, web content, etc. One of our most esteemed providers is illustrator Robert W. Zalo. I work on all my most important projects like book covers, logos, web design elements with Robert. As an illustrator, he worked on the Ignatz-nominated comic book, The Expert's Guide to Killing Things That Go Bump in the Night. His skills encompass advertising, magazine illustrations, gaming, comic books, TV production, and scenic painting. His clients include Comcast, Adelphia, Haven Talent, Forceworks, High Octane Theater, Star Creative Advertising. If you wish to contact Robert, go to johnnybluestar.com and let me know. That's johnnybluestar.com. For artist, illustrator Robert Zalo, an essential component of all the work we do. Maybe he can help you too.
If
If you like Threshold Radio, a program which deals with core issues affecting our personal, political, and spiritual lives, and advocates the creation of an enlightened, informed citizenry, not only in America, but throughout the world, then you might think of supporting both your product and business and our message by advertising on our show. All programs are archived and are supported in various ways, including social media, our outreach being broadcast weekly on VegasAllNetRadio.com, a very advanced internet broadcasting station, but also archived directly on our websites on YouTube and in SoundCloud. We believe in time we will have a very broad outreach. Through New Galaxy Enterprises, our parent company, we can create a wide range of marketing and advertising components to complement your advertising on Threshold Radio and increase your outreach in many creative and exciting ways. If interested, just go to www.thresholdradio.com and fill out a contact form with your interest. That's www.thresholdradio.com.
We're back with Robert Snow, author of Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic, a former homicide detective who suddenly plunged into a rather important, I believe, investigation of the past lifetime experience. I think the one thing about your regression that amazed me, Robert, and in fact correlated with some of my experience, was your description of yourself when you, quote, woke up, so to speak, in another body in another time. Owing to one important but unique experience in my life, I woke up in a dream in a world that was every bit as vivid and real as the one I lived in, and knowing I was full well in another room sleeping, this changed my life and perspective permanently. So I wasn't skeptical when I heard you say you saw yourself in an entirely different environment, because I've experienced something like that yourself, not with a past lifetime though. In this case, you were in an entirely different body in a world quite different than ours. In your book, you said, quote, however, what really set this experience apart was that I had control of it. I could look around. This wasn't like a dream in which whatever events were occurring controlled what I saw and where my attention was drawn. I could control this experience. I could decide where I wanted to look and what I wanted to look at and what. And while most dreams have some type of action going on that propels the plot, in this case, nothing was happening other than a light breeze blowing. I was simply standing alone in a beautiful valley. There was nothing else happening. It occurred to me that this was like some kind of virtual reality game, except that the landscape didn't have a cartoon feel to it. Instead, it looked vividly realistic. But I realized, like virtual reality, it only looked as if the world I found myself standing in was genuine, while I knew it really wasn't. In my mind, I may have thought I was standing in a valley. I may have thought I could feel the breeze in my face. However, I knew it was just a trick brought on by the hypnosis. And that's an example of the fascinating subject matter, but also the clarity of your writing. Tell us more about this experience, where you found yourself actually.
Well, after I said about 10 or 12 tries of trying to get me to land the balloon, Dr. Griffiths kind of changed her idea. She said, okay, she says, see if you can imagine a mountain. And it's kind of funny because I think by that time I was so tired and sitting there, my hands clasped my lap. I hadn't moved. My back was hurting and my buttocks were hurting. As I could see a mountain in my mind, it wasn't clear. It was just like imagine, you know, you could see a mountain. She said, okay, go to the mountain and land the balloon. So I actually saw myself, you know, imagine myself landing the balloon in the mountain. Again, I think by that time I was tired. I was wanting to, you know, willing to say or do anything. But anyway, she said, okay. She said, now there's a cabin on the mountain. She says, go into the cabin. So she says, what do you see? And I didn't see anything. And I told her, I don't see anything. It's dark. I figure this is her daydream, not mine. I'm not going to imagine nothing. So she said, okay, imagine a big, you know, bright cabin with food. And so I'm cooperating. I'm imagining it. So we get down with that. And finally she says, okay. She says, now leave the cabin. She said, there are 12 steps going down into the valley. She says, I want you to go down these steps, and I'm going to count the steps as you go down. And I said, okay, I'm trying to imagine myself walking down some steps. I'm being cooperative. And she starts 12. Then she starts, every time she counts, her words get longer. It's 11, 10, you know, this kind of thing. You know what? You say everybody's seen TV and movie program and hypnotist. You figure what she's doing. You know, 9, you know, 8. So we're counting down the steps. But interestingly, when she got to 1, something really bizarre happened. Not that I would imagine or, you know, could see it in my mind working in a valley. I was in a valley. I mean, at the moment, it was startling for a few moments, needless to say, because this wasn't imagination, a dream. I was standing in a valley. It was as vivid, as clear as anything I'd ever seen. But at the same time, I could still feel myself sitting on the couch. I knew I was still in Dr. Griffith's office. I could hear her move in the chair next to me, and I could feel myself sitting on the couch. But at the same time, I was in the valley. Now, I wasn't too stupid. I knew what this was. I knew that I had been hypnotized, and I knew this was just hypnotism. But still, at the time, I hadn't expected anything like this. It was extremely startling, but it was also kind of fun. I mean, it was kind of like when they find one of those coolest rides at amusement park. I mean, if you go into a big amusement park, you go into rides. I mean, they look real, they feel real, but you know they're not really real. And that's what I thought about this. This is just a trick brought about the hypnotism. But it was fascinating because I was there. I could see the leaves moving on the trees. I mean, I could feel a breeze in my face. At the time, I just assumed that had to be the air conditioning in her office. I mean, that's the only reason I could come to. But anyway, I thought this is kind of cool. I mean, contrary to what she said to start the thing, I wasn't scared, I wasn't frightened. You know, I was more just kind of amazed. It was like a virtual reality. I mean, virtual reality may look real and everything. You know, it's not, and I knew this wasn't real, but it looked real and it felt real. It was fun. So
you know, I've read a lot about past lifetime experiences, and this is what immediately caught me about yours, that you woke up in this world and you were really there. And if it hadn't happened to me, I might not have recognized it, because it is not the same as just being in a hypnotic state and sort of encountering things and seeing things in your imagination that from the past. It's actually being there.
But my point is, I had never been hypnotized, so I didn't really know what it was. I really didn't know if this was just what being hypnotized is like or what. But I would tell you, really honestly, I was kind of enjoying it. Again, it was like finding the coolest ride you'd ever had on an amusement park and wanting to keep going on it all the time. And so Dr. Griffith asked me she said, describe yourself. So I looked out myself. I looked down, and it's funny, I could see a pair of bare feet, kind of hairy legs, and I was wearing fur. And I was holding a big piece of a tree limb in my left hand. Everybody's seen movies and TV and read books. You know what cavemen look like. And I didn't realize until I listened to the tape later that I remembered the moment she had told me just before I hit the bottom step, I want you to go back to the very first life you lived on Earth. Go back to the very first time you were here on Earth. But I didn't realize it. I didn't realize it until later. But I looked at it, and I said, I know what a caveman looked like. And I think this is, I think this is my imagination. This is all just having fun with me. So I described myself to her and all this, and she said, okay. Then, kind of funny, something happened, kind of funny. It was like there was a part of my mind that I never used before was suddenly coming into play, because all of a sudden I would say things to Dr. Griffith that I didn't know what I was going to say. It just spill off my lips before I knew I was going to say it, which caught me by surprise, because, you know, before you say something, you have a few seconds or two to think about what you're going to say. But I said, this is where I live. I live up on the hill, and I could look up beside the valley, and I could see a big rocky outcropping. I told her, that's where I live. And I thought it was kind of funny, because I didn't know this valley, but the person body I was in did. They knew this valley. They recognized it, and they recognized this place as their home. And I would start saying things to her without knowing I was going to say them. They go right out of my brain on my lips without passing my conscious mind.
Yeah. Well, that is the second very interesting thing about your experience. One, you're in an actual world, which I don't think is normal for a hypnotic regression. And the second thing is that somehow you could say it's that voice of the person, but you could also say it's sort of a higher voice, because that person's been dead a long time. And something in you, some other part of yourself is speaking. Tell us about the death that you had in that cave.
Well, Dr. Griffith told me, she says, okay, because for the first few minutes or two of the regression, I'm just walking along this valley. It's a beautiful green valley. It's high summer. Leaves are everywhere. And like I said, blowing. She said, all right, go to where you live. And in fact, I didn't walk there. It was like there'd be a few moments of kind of a gray fog. And next thing I knew, I was staying at the mouth of a cave. And the funny part about this one was, when I walked into the cave, I felt this person who lived there wasn't very hygienic. I mean, I had this awful odor come to me as I walked in the cave. And I remember the time thinking, where could that come from? You know, I'm sitting in an office and I had this awful smell of a very unhygienic person. So you know, I would describe the cave to her and all that. And Dr. Griffith finally said, okay, now I want you to go to your death. Tell me what you see. So again, there'd be, two or three seconds of gray fog. Then suddenly I wasn't in the body any longer. I was kind of floating about 10 feet above. And I was in the cave and I could look down. And I could see a skinny little man covered with furs, and he was coughing. He was shaking and coughing. And I could tell he was really sick. And he was, it looked like every time he coughed, it was really painful. And the person was dying. And Dr. Griff said, okay. He says, now I want you to go out of the cave. He said, look for the light. So I go out of the cave, and there's a big bright light on top of the valley. But before, she said, go into the light. Before I did, I was hitting, I started speaking again before I knew I was going to say it. And I told her, this was a bad life. I said, this is a bad life. I had to learn what it was like to be completely alone, to not have anyone. And I, again, I didn't know what I was going to say. It just kind of caught me by surprise. So she said, okay, go into the light. She said, I want you to go to a life where you did have someone. Go to a life where you had someone important to you. And so I go in, I go up into the light. And again, there's about 3 or 4 seconds of nothing, just kind of a gray fog. And the next thing I see, I'm on a street. I'm on a city street. I'm walking along the sidewalk. But I could tell it wasn't from present days because there were gas lights and horse-drawn carriages. And again, this is just as clear as any reality I'd ever seen. But the funny part was, it was a very sunny day. And I could feel the sun beating down on me. And I thought how bizarre that was because I was in a dark and closed office. And I said, she said, okay, where you at? And I told her, I'm in a city. I said, I don't know where. I said, but she said, what? You know, she asked me the date. And I told her it looked like the late 1800s. Because right. Gas lights, horse-drawn carriages.
And then after that, you saw yourself in the street. You wound up in a kind of studio. What did you find there?
Well, what happened? She asked me, she says, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to meet someone. She says, who? I said, a woman. I said, okay. So go. He said, you meet her. So I met this woman on the street. We went to this little sidewalk cafe. And she asked me, what do you order? I said, she orders some kind of special water. I order a glass of wine. I said, okay. She said, now go to the next scene. She said, she'd always say, like, go 5 years to the next scene. So again, there's a little gray fog after that sidewalk cafe, and I'm in a hallway of like an apartment building, and I have an argument with a woman who I told Dr. Griffin was my wife. We're having some kind of argument. I don't know what the argument's about. We're having an argument, but I just turn and walk away, and I walk down the hallway into another room, and it's an artist studio. It's got a gigantic, the whole roof is a skylight. And one wall is all windows, and there are just dozens of paintings hanging around everywhere. And again, I didn't know this place. Bob Snow didn't know this place, but the person I was in did. I told Dr. Griffin, this is where I work. I paint portraits. I told her I paint portraits. I hate painting portraits. I said that 3 or 4 times. I hate painting portraits, but I need the money. This is where I work.
And money was a very important thing to this individual.
It's funny. You could feel this person, it was like a driving force for this person. I said, I kept telling her, I need the money. But I don't like painting portraits, but I need the money.
And this is quite different than your perception of yourself in this lifetime. This is a completely different character because you had a steady job and you had a side job as a writer. And this was not – you were more in a regular place that ordinary people are who have a steady income, right?
Yeah. Bob Snow wasn't experiencing any of this, but the body I was in was experiencing. I could feel this body. It was almost a desperation of this person about money, about not liking to paint portraits. But the walls were covered with all kind of paintings. A lot of them were portraits. And apparently, he hadn't been able to sell a lot of them.
Well, we're going to go back to this lifetime in just a few minutes, but right now, we're going to. Talk about a little bit about someone named Patty Greer.
Patty Greer journeyed to England to investigate crop circles, eventually becoming a filmmaker, chronicling this phenomena and serving as a kind of intermediary between the unknown creators and the humanity on the brink of global disaster. Hear her complete story by visiting Show One, Patty Greer, Crop Circle Mysteries in our Threshold Radio Archives in Vegas, AllNetRadio.com and YouTube. Here's one of our songs.
Take me following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here, there's too many of them!" Again, this other Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped two hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
We're back with Robert Snow, author of Portrait of a Past Lifetime Skeptic and former homicide detective with the Indianapolis Police Department, telling us about his first regression experience into past lifetimes. And one thing about this, Robert, about we're going to get much more into the artist's life, but let's talk about for a second his death as guided by the hypnotist.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Griffin, again, I went to a couple more scenes of this person's life. I was at a party where a bunch of people congratulate me. I didn't know what for, but I was the star of the party. They were congratulating me. I went to a scene where I was walking through a gigantic garden. I was really depressed. Again, I didn't know what I was depressed about. No, I just knew who this person was. So finally, Dr. Griffin said, "Okay, I want you to go to your death." Because it turns out, apparently, after I found out later, I guess in any life, the death is the most important moment because you kind of review your life and see what you did accomplish and didn't accomplish. So right. She said, "Go to your death." So I saw myself laying in bed, and I saw myself die. And then I saw myself racing out of the body and going through a roof. But again, at the time, I thought, everybody's seen ghost stories. Everybody knows what happened. You die, you go out of the body, you know. And I saw myself passing through this roof, and that wasn't anything amazing. But it's funny, and again, I started talking, didn't know what I was going to say. And I told Dr. Griffin, she asked me, "What did you regret about this life?" And I said, "I regret we didn't have any children because my wife couldn't have children." And I said, I didn't know I was going to say that, but I said it. So yeah, I rise out of the body, and I'm over the top of a large city, a huge city. You can see lights for miles in all directions. And Darth Vader says, "Go into the light." And there's a light up above me, a bright light. But it's interesting because people seem to think when you're hypnotized that you're under the control of the hypnotist. You know, they make you get up. You ever seen these stage hypnotists that make people get up and cluck like chickens and stuff? Well, that's not true, because when you're in hypnotism, you're still in control. Because Dr. Griffith said, "Go to the light," and I didn't. Instead, I saw myself flying through some woods, and I could tell that it looked like it was late fall. It wasn't quite winter yet because the trees still had leaves, but it looked like it was a really cold, brisk night, a fall night. So anything, I'm flying through this woods, and all of a sudden I come out, I'm looking in the window on the second or third floor of this big mansion. And I'm in a room, and there's a big fire in the fireplace. Nobody's in the room, but there's a big fire in the fireplace, and there's a painting over the fireplace. And Dr. Griffith, and I told Dr. Griffith, I wanted to see one of my paintings before I left this life. I wanted to see one of my paintings one more time. And over the fireplace was a still life. It had a bottle and some fruit and a big sun in it. And I wanted to see my painting one more time before I died. And I thought that was kind of interesting, only to show that the hypnotist is really not in charge of the hypnotic session. Because again, she would tell me to do things, and if I wanted to do them, I would. If I didn't, I wouldn't. So it was kind of funny. Yeah.
Well, you know, now one of your experiences during this time took place in the body of a woman, a Greek girl. This actually occurred between the two separate past life visits to the artist that we're talking about in your first hypnotic regression, who turned out to be your last lifetime. What kind of a shock was it for a hard-boiled homicide detective to recognize their lifetime as a woman?
Well, it's kind of funny because after I went to the light as the artist, Dr. Griffith said, "Okay, so I want you to go back to a life when you were a female." And I kind of almost laughed, and I thought this is going to be the deal buster. I thought this is going to show this is all phony. I mean, how could I do that? I mean, this is all make believe and subconscious. How could I do that? So I thought it was kind of funny. I almost laughed. So anyway, again, you go in the gray fog, And three or four seconds later, I come out, and I'm standing in some more woods. But it's not the valley. It's a level woods. I'm standing in front of this big marble, look like marble or limestone monument. And I look down, and it's a woman's body. And at the time, I'm completely confused at the time. You know, I'm thinking, where could this come from? You know, then you think, well, maybe, you know, there's been movies about men dressing up as women. You know, Tom Hanks had his first TV program like that. You know, there was some call it hot, you know, some like a hot type thing with, you know, Tony Curtis. I thought, that's all this is. You know, you see movies for men dressed like women. This has to be where this is coming from. And that's the only thing it could be. I couldn't imagine how else it could be. So we go. So she asked about my life, and I had a life as an altar girl in ancient Greece. This is in ancient Greece, and I go through this life in ancient Greece as a young woman. It was still kind of interesting. It was bizarre at that moment. Needless to say, being in a woman's body was very bizarre. But again, I still didn't think it was anything but the hypnotism. So we go through the life as a Greek woman, but it was kind of a sad life where you had to be a virgin to work at this temple. Well, apparently I violated that and had a child, and they got rid of me, and I turned out I gave my child up to go on about my own type thing. And so anyway, so I finally went to my death as a Greek woman. That was the only scary part of the whole regression, is that when the woman died, she'd gone to a village where it was next to a big, either a sea or an ocean, and she died in a drought. She drowned in a fishing accident, got caught in a net and drowned. And I could taste salt water. As she was dying, I could taste salt water. It was kind of frightening for a few moments. And fortunately, Dr. Griffith, I could see this and got me out of this life. She said, okay. She said, Bob, I want you to go back to your most recent past life. Go back to the life you lived before you were Bob Snow. And I was really kind of glad to get out of this life as a woman. Not only for the drowning, but I had felt this tremendous guilt about giving my daughter up. I went back and gave my daughter to the temple so she could work at the temple like I had. So I knew it would be easier for me to get on with my life if I didn't have a child with me. Well, I felt this tremendous guilt. And I thought, and I meant at the time thinking how stupid this was, because this is all make-believe. Why would you feel guilty? It's make-believe.
But well, in the next hour, we're going to go into many more details of your investigation. But right now, we're going to go out with a little bit of music by Edgar Ahrens, a Russian composer I've worked with. And this is a piece that he, just a short piece called I'll Go With You.